Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 72. It's August 7th, 2020. The unlikely specter of hippie redneck fusion and its relation to Anglo-Texan identity had been on the imagined horizon for some time. The period from 1968 to 1970 offered a number of glimpses of the developing trope. We have already encountered the media's portrayal of the diverse audience at Janis Joplin's last Central Texas appearance, as well as Spencer Perskin's country fiddle at the heart of Shiva's headband, Psychedelic Rock. And another example from 1970, Bud Schrake spent several days exploring environmental politics in the big thicket of East Texas, but found himself shunned at every turn. Prospects did not look good for the article he meant to file with Sports Illustrated, and not only because the magazine's new owners had investments in the region's lumber concerns. Schrake's editor, Andre Laguerre, passed on the resulting article, and it ended up in Harper's instead, under the title Land of the Permanent Wave. In it, Schrake made his shunning by local residents and his attempts to rectify the situation the centerpiece of his narrative. Schrake's challenge was that he matched locals' visual cues of the hippie. A tall, Fort Worth native with Texas accent and swagger, Schrake had spent the past several years in New York, grown his hair long, and adopted other countercultural habits. The conflicting image created no small amount of consternation. For about 5 hours, I'd been drinking Scotch whiskey and arguing with a rather nice, sometimes funny old fellow named Arch, Schrake noted, who was so offended by my moderately long hair that he demanded to know if I weren't actually, secretly, a communist. As it turned out, Schrake's most obvious sin in East Texas was sartorial, and the meanings projected by his hair could be easily redirected. Then the notion struck me that I could quite simply change all this. I went to the parking lot, opened the trunk of the car, and put on a battered, well-crushed cowboy hat that I've owned for several years. As I turned back toward the coffee shop, there stood the cop. His mean face slowly resolved into a baffled, respectful expression, like that of a weasel facing a trap. "Good morning," he said. "Hot some bitch today," I said. "Yes, sir, it is." In donning the cowboy hat, Schrake's social difficulties disappeared. State Senator Charlie Wilson, who was with Schrake on this trip, congratulated me on having lived for a week bareheaded in East Texas without being beaten with a tire iron. With this hat on, they can see your hair hanging down, but a long-haired cowboy is likely to be a dangerous man best left alone. Schrake was not alone in discovering the guise's powers. The apparent fact that the appropriation of markers of Texanness allowed for dissenters to re-enter the community, if uneasily, even as they attempted to refashion what it meant to be Texan. In this time and place, a previously besieged countercultural sensibility attained a heightened visibility and acceptance through the revaluation of regional identity markers. The artists, text firms, and audiences involved all invite discussion on their own terms. But a fuller understanding requires an appreciation of their cohesion as a larger scene. Normally, the notion of musical scene leans heavily on its origins in the theater, suggesting that audiences, industry, venues, and cityscapes serve as a backdrop for musical performance. More than mere setting, however, a scene such as Austin in the 1970s constitutes a dense web of social, political, economic, and affective relations that give meaning to and not merely adorn the performance of popular music. By understanding this larger subjective context, we can begin to make sense of why the Armadillo World Headquarters, Eddie Wilson remembers, the me decade in the following manner. We felt the rush of joyful and energetic optimism that comes when you realize that the giant tug of war is beginning to shift in your favor. Voices begin to speak in unison. New power rushes from your fingers through your shoulders, then down your back, into your legs, and suddenly we've got the bastards on the run. Why would Wilson frame a pop cultural endeavor so squarely in terms of struggle? He speaks here about much more than music. His Armadillo World Headquarters visibly aligned itself with what it saw as the rising tide of new politics in Texas and briefly reconfigured mainstream representations of the Texan with countercultural aesthetics and progressive political concerns. And now, by the way, I'm skipping ahead about 12 pages. In addition to boots, hats, and hair, the expressive function of brand loyalty to Texas beers such as Lone Star, Pearl, and Shiner in the regional subculture should not be underestimated. As late as the 1970s, the United States was still a map of fairly distinct beer sheds. Indeed, the regulatory laws governing interstate commerce in alcoholic beverages, holdovers from the prohibitionist impulse, served as the basic conceit for the popular 1977 film Smokey and the Bandit. In Texas in the 1970s, the drinking age, like the voting age, fell to 18, and liquor by the drink first became available in Austin. In the beginning, the Armadillo World headquarters did not intend to serve alcohol at all, following the example of the Vulcan Gas Company, but economics and demand intervened. Soon enough, as Armadillo employee Fletcher Clark recalled, "If music was the soul of the Armadillo, beer was certainly its blood." Promotional materials would claim that only the Astrodome sold more beer than the Armadillo. Accordingly, bartending became one of the most prestigious positions on the Armadillo floor, and not coincidentally, a strictly male domain. Male bartenders claimed that women did not have the discriminating taste to tell the difference between finely crafted Texas beers, each of which had its rabid partisans. As an experiment, employee Leah Meckling switched the lines to the Lone Star and Pearl taps. Genius. No one noticed for days. For all of the blustery attachment to Lone Star, Pearl, and Shiner beers then, the attraction owed not to taste but to cultural capital, the beer's association with working-class lifestyles and country music. The Armadillo World Headquarters' early lack of a beer and wine license made for some tense, near confrontations with local authorities. In one such instance, Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission officials burst into the offices of the Armadillo, where a small group was partaking of alcohol. Luckily for the venue's countercultural denizens, Monday Night Football announcer and former Dallas Cowboys quarterback Don Meredith was among them, a guest of Bud Schrake. The officers lit up upon recognizing Meredith, who put his hands on their shoulders, escorted them out the doors, and signed autographs. Eddie Wilson grabbed Bobby Hederman by the elbow and told him to go get one of the gaudy basketball trophies they happened to have in storage under the stage. "I gave the trophy to Eddie, and he took it to the stage as the band finished their set," Hederman recalled. Eddie relayed to the audience what had just taken place and called Don Meredith to the stage. Underneath the anemic stage lights, Don accepted the trophy. "You may not know it," he said, "but this is what I really always wanted." Such prestigious contacts eased the Armadillo's way with traditional audiences and legal authorities and marked the city's evolution from the hostility shown the Vulcan Gas Company. The interpretation of the Austin scene as a Texas lifestyle crafted from the traditional commodities of beer, boots, and hats made for a kind of folk culture that interested the scholars at the University of Texas, just as Dobie and Betacek had theorized an organic Anglo-Texas nationalism joining men and land. Progressive country and its attendant fashions suggested a performance of the Texan that often claimed a natural relationship among the homologous elements of the subculture rather than their artifice. The notion of authenticity, though, need not be a boogeyman here, as these performances possessed a great deal of self-consciousness. Further, there may well be an authentic element to such musics and styles in Central Texas. As ethnomusicologist Aaron Fox has defended the concept in its relation to country music performance in nearby Lockhart, the working class claims on country music is coherent, justified, and ethical. The working class claim on country music is coherent, justified, and ethical, that is to say, authentic. Explaining country culturally in terms of forms of personal and communal local music practices rather than industrial mediated processes is not to folklorize country music or to lose sight of political economy. Country music has long invited such fierce contestation over its claims to authenticity as it conveys a certain organic relationship, fusing ideas of the American nation, whiteness, and rurality. I'm going to stop there. These are two different passages from Jason Mellard's book, Progressive Country, How the 1970s Transformed the Texan in Popular Culture. And, just as a name drop, a couple of sections, it's just incredible. I've read from Harvey Penick's Little Green Book, lately. I don't think I've opened the first volume, The Little Red Book, yet on the Dispatches. They're both great. Bud Schrake is the writer, the co-writer with Pienaar of those. And I know almost nothing about Bud Schrake other than he's considered a legend among Texas writers of the period, one among a whole host of these great writers that were here while all of this music and everything was going on, and Willie and all of that. You know, there were a bunch of great writers in town then. There are a bunch of great writers in town now. And it's incredible to see his name here and to imagine him out for Sports Illustrated covering some sort of environmental topic in 1970 out in East Texas and being completely dismissed, if not really endangered. And all he needed to do, though, was to go to his car and put on an old cowboy hat that he had. And that's an interesting and kind of creepy, cautionary, and eye-opening statement, though, isn't it? Because you know, he's a white guy, so he just puts on a hat, and presto, completely different guys. Not so easy if you're not white. That just kind of is that's a leaf coming along in the stream here of this whole thing. But this man, Arch, wanting to know if he were actually secretly a communist. And then it's amazing, just kind of coincidental, that he out on the trip, he was with State Senator Charlie Wilson, later U.S. Rep, I believe. And Aaron Sorkin picks up that tale for Charlie Wilson's War. That particular individual later contributing to a lot of flow of funds into Afghanistan to arm the Mujahideen against the Soviets. Crazy, just crazy. And I always love reading about the Armadillo and Eddie and that gang and imagining the place. Never saw it, my own eyes, inside or out, just photographs. And the story of also of Don Meredith there to help them survive a night where the cops show up into a back room and staff's drinking beer, which they don't have a beer license. And Don Meredith, you know, being Dallas Cowboys quarterback, makes everything okay, signs autographs. That's a funny, vivid, hilarious, only in Texas kind of story. I mean, frankly, I'm sure there's, you got your versions in Indiana, Michigan, and everywhere else, but it's incredibly Texas tale. I love it. Love everything about it. And there's kind of this little offhanded comment here, and it marked the city's evolution from the hostility shown the Vulcan Gas Company. Apparently in the 60s, the police were just after the Vulcan Gas Company, which I always thought was on the outskirts, but I learned at some point that it was right there on Congress Avenue, downtown, north of the river. And I think there are a heavy amount of psychedelic drugs going on in the place, hence the cops' interest. And it's, you know, I know nothing of this period of time where if you had long hair, you were going to get beat up. Charlie Wilson remarking to Schrake, they congratulated me on having lived for a week bareheaded in East Texas without being beaten with a tire iron, and bareheaded with long hair. So sounds very rough and tumble. Also, I had the good fortune of meeting Leah Meckling, who's mentioned in this story. It's a genius move on her part. They're only letting the Armadillo guys be bartenders and apparently puffing themselves up that it's sort of their particular refinement about beer. And so what does she do but secretly switches the lines to the beer taps between Lone Star and Pearl. Nobody notices. Genius. Just genius. She, when I met her, she runs formerly the South Austin Museum of Popular Culture. Then it became the Austin Museum of Popular Culture, principally because it was no longer in South Austin. It moved north into the top floor, behind in the building behind Threadgill's on North Lamar. I have no idea. I presume they're also having to vacate now, leaving and looking for a new home. She and her compatriots have an incredible collection of artifacts, posters, and all kinds of stuff. T-shirts from Austin in the 60s and 70s and up through to today, and do periodic exhibits. We were going to have on May 1st, this year's edition of the Regulars Day Off, in that room, surrounded by her, incredible artifacts and assets. We're going to get to watch a movie I always forget the last names. If it's Barbara Conrad Smith or Barbara Smith Conrad, a woman who's, she's now deceased. She grew up in East Texas, mentioned here, and she couldn't, as it were, just put on a cowboy hat and change her costume sufficient to disappear whatever was offending these particular folks. She was a black girl. She's an African-American, grew up in East Texas, and she was in the first class of undergrads that integrated the University of Texas, and she was an incredible, truly world-class operatic talent. And so auditions for an opera as a UT freshman, and given her gifts and work ethic, she's cast as the female lead. I think it's called Dido, and I think, as the story goes, in Dido, there's a kiss between the female lead and the male lead. The male lead was cast with a white actor, and individuals in the Texas State Legislature let UT know that if they didn't remove her from that role, that they would pull funding. And this is at a time when state funding dominates the revenue for the University of Texas system. It's quite diminished these days, but at the time it was an overwhelming force. It makes for an incredible tale, an incredible movie. We're going to get to watch that there, eat at Threadgill's. And we're going to be joined by a bunch of Eddie's friends who are these very writers. But Trake's no longer around, I don't believe. But there's Jan Reed still is. I don't know if he was going to join us, but Jan Reed is part of a group that Eddie meets with every once in a while. I don't know that they've been able to do it lately. And as far as I know, Eddie's not on Zoom. But it's a group of writers, and they gather. And Eddie calls the regulars the propeller heads, and the writers the knuckleheads. And we were going to have essentially a mixer. We were going to combine the two streams. And it was just going to be a treasure for all of us to get to hang out with these folks, these writers, who told the stories, invented the stories, were there for these, you know, real stories. It was just going to be the greatest. So this was on my mind, obviously, having read yesterday what I did from the Talent Code about ignition and a sense of place. And I just started looking. I actually picked up this book trying to find the story when Willie told Waylon to get to Austin, or that Austin, something special was going down in Austin, whatever that was. I was trying to find that tale. I probably should just pick up Joe Nick Potosky's biography of Willie Nelson. And also seeing Don Meredith here, Joe Nick wrote like 800 page history of the Dallas Cowboys, in addition to biographies of Stevie Ray Vaughan and many others. I think he's even come out in the last few years with a long history of Austin. So there's just an endless amount of this great stuff. And don't want it to all be nostalgia either. We're all here. We're all alive. One of the most punishing things about these lockdowns is it's keeping us from experiencing this place. It's going to be interesting to see when everything comes back, when things gradually come back on stream. I'm sort of just trying to, you know, just taking it a week at a time, what's coming next, and not trying to get too down about the fact that Threadgill's is gone and a lot of other establishments are gone. Many are still hurting, and we're a long way from being out of this thing. All of Threadgill's artifacts and awesome physical sort of stuff is going to get auctioned off this weekend. And hopefully that's a boon, a windfall for Eddie and Sandra. They deserve it. I think, you know, he owns that plot of land too. So hopefully that's going to be great for him. Financially, at least, it's the old Woody Allen quote. Wealth, what is it? Wealth is better than poverty, if only for financial reasons. Hopefully that'll be all right for him financially, but it is nonetheless, I know he feels the sting of the loss, and we all are just going to miss it. We're just going to miss it. So it's up to us really to reignite the fire, if you will, and make our own thing and tell the tales and share the tales. And this Jason Mellard, I met him through Eddie. I think he was a PhD student at the time. He's a professor now, PhD. And this is like an academic work on all of this terrain, the music, the places, the people, all tied up in this kind of these academic notions of Texan-ness and so it's a different lens on all this stuff than just the written, somebody like Eddie telling his tales, and or Joe Nick, and you know, Ray Benson's got his own great book as well. So anyway, on my mind, what can we do with four in of Austin? And hopefully we can get, you know, back to where we're all experiencing full Austin soon. This period of that being highly curtailed and forcing me to look at friends through damn thumbnails on Zoom and other stuff has got to go. It's all fine. And there's the benefits of, you know, some of the regulars are joining us from Stockholm and Philly and Albuquerque and Cleveland. But come on, we can keep that, and very eager for us to get back at it and experience the full range of the magic that is Austin. And sad for the Threadgills auction. If y'all pick up anything this weekend, let me know. Have a great one, and I will talk with you soon.